This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The world rolls on hotter than ever. This week on Radio Eco Shock, who knew and when? Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News reveals the investigation into the world's biggest oil company, ExxonMobil. They knew their product would damage the climate, starting in the late 1970s, but chose to fund denial. Then we examine the end of plenty with National Geographic author Joel K. Bourne. He says the projected future of food and population isn't going to happen. There are a few other goodies along the way, maybe even a happy spot. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for joining in. Let's get started. The world's largest oil company knew climate change would result from their products as early as the 1970s. That's just part of startling revelations coming out of an investigation by Inside Climate News. To get the whole scoop, we've reached their senior investigative journalist, Neela Banerjee. Neela, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
How did you and your team get started on this massive story about Exxon?
Started as a broader project looking into early climate change research. And as we started to do this, a scientist we spoke to who had worked for the U.S. Energy Department noted that Exxon had contributed to this research and to peer-reviewed journals. And we thought that was unusual given the known history of Exxon's involvement in climate, starting from about 1990 on when it worked hard to delay action on climate change. So Exxon got on our radar that way, and then we tried to see if other companies were involved. We didn't hear any mention of any other companies. Then what happened was that, separate from this, I got a transcript of a congressional hearing, a U.S. congressional hearing in 1979, which is much earlier than we thought there'd been hearings on climate change. And just on a lark, it was a PDF document, I decided to look up Exxon. And sure enough, there was a gentleman from Exxon at this 1979 hearing. So the peer-reviewed work had been about 1983, 1984, which to us already seemed quite early. All of a sudden, seeing this man's name, it was Henry Shaw, in that transcript moved the clock back to 1979. So I started to look into, who is Henry Shaw? And started to Google him and discover that he was an author of a paper that was done describing a project launched in 1979 by Exxon using one of its supertankers to take samples of CO2 in the oceans as the tanker went from the Gulf of Mexico to the Persian Gulf. So, you know, that became the thread we started to pull on. Henry Shaw is dead, but one of his co-authors, Ed Garvey, is alive. We spoke to him, and we hopscotched from person to person. We discovered archives, and, you know, through just old-fashioned shoe leather and phone calls, we managed to pull this together.
And, you know, the irony is a bunch of bloggers and denialists, some of them likely receiving funding from Exxon, kept pushing the myth that climate scientists in the 1970s only warned about the coming ice age and not global warming. Doesn't this blow that myth right out of the water?
Yeah, I mean, it is a really interesting point. You know, nobody has mentioned that whole canard until now. And you're right. You know, people to this day continue to mock climate science because they say, well, you know, scientists said this back in the 70s, and now they're saying that. Well, I actually don't think scientists said it, or maybe it was one scientist and Newsweek covered it, but it's more that Exxon was following the science of the time, or Exxon scientists were following it, and they reported it back to their top executives. In the first story of our series, we have a scene that we got from the documents of one of Exxon's senior scientists, a man named Jim Black, reporting to Exxon's management committee in 1977 about the emerging science around CO2 emissions and climate change. And he said, you know, the prevailing scientific opinion is that these CO2 emissions come from burning fossil fuels. And in about a decade, it's going to be time to make some hard choices about energy use. He didn't say it in any kind of biased or critical fashion, I mean, other than, you know, scientific skepticism and inquiry. He just laid it out there. It was very neutral. It's what you would expect a scientist in academia to say. And that was the tone from the outset until about 1986, because that's, you know, we have documents for now.
So where did you find all those internal Exxon reports and correspondence from the early days of their climate research?
From various sources, from a lot of archives, you know, went to a lot of different places and found them and digitized them, and we're sharing them, you know, as the stories come out. There's a lot, you know, there's thousands of pages, but and while it completes a picture, the most telling documents I would say are maybe, you know, two dozen.
And how far did Exxon go with its early climate research? Can you tell us more?
Oh, sure. So the first project that they launched was in 1979, was this tanker project that I mentioned earlier. And it was ambitious when you think about it. It didn't cost a lot of money as far as, you know, a company the size of Exxon goes. But it meant a lot of coordination among various Exxon divisions, and that's kind of a big deal, according to one of the scientists on the project. And for that kind of coordination to go on, it needed sign-off at the very top levels of the company. So they deployed this tanker. I mean, the tanker was going anyway, taking oil and so on, but they outfitted it with specially made equipment, and they seconded, you know, several men to the project, technicians and engineers and scientists. So they did that from 1979 to about 1982. Starting around 1980, Exxon decided that they needed to know more about climate modeling. Climate modeling at that time was primitive. You know, any scientist could have told you. And Exxon was following it, but they decided to hire mathematicians and atmospheric scientists and others, I guess, to but definitely mathematicians, to do mathematical modeling of the Earth's climate and how it would be affected by greater CO2 emissions. And there was an overlap between the tanker project and the modeling. By 1982, the price of oil had fallen precipitously. Exxon was making cuts everywhere. The tanker project seemed expensive, and so they decided to cut that. We don't see any other consideration. It didn't seem like that cut came out of denial or anything like that. But they decided to continue with their modeling efforts, and those modeling efforts continued and generated peer-reviewed papers, some of which were praised by, you know, academics and government scientists. All of that continued until about 1986. Then the layoffs that were happening at Exxon led to a sharp reduction at the research staff. And from 1986 to the present day, Exxon's continued to do climate research, but more narrowly focused, and certainly not anything that would imperil their business. Like, some of the research I've seen looks at whether natural gas is better than coal for the climate, but it doesn't really look at, you know, some of the bigger issues that they were looking at in the early 80s.
Do we know for sure that these scientists managed to warn top executives in the company about the dangerous risks of climate change in those early days?
Yes, we do. We have documents that show that, and we've shared those documents on our website. So, for example, that first meeting I was telling you about that this scientist named Jim Black gave before the management committee. The management committee is the top level of the company. It's the chairman and CEO and the senior vice presidents. They're the men, and they were all men, who made decisions about the company and its priorities. Later, we have documents that showed Exxon's managers and executives from their research and engineering unit, where all this climate research was going on, that they kept senior vice presidents apprised regularly about climate change. We have letters and from managers and kind of lower-level executives all the way to the upper ranks. And then we also have we even have documents that reflect the interest that those men took in climate science. So, for example, there's a memo written by a gentleman from Exxon Research and Engineering called Harold Weinberg, and he writes about a senior vice president's pointedly discussing oceans and their role in climate change and the carbon cycle. I mean, they were versed about it, and they were talking to their scientists and challenging them and kicking around different theories. So that was one of the most exciting things in our research, was that the documents we found showed that interest in climate change and climate research went all the way up to the executive suites. And therefore, Exxon couldn't say to us, oh, well, yeah, of course, you know, these scientists, they're off doing their own research, and it's, you know, it really doesn't mean anything. It's distant from our bigger corporate considerations. And what we saw was that, you know, they weren't.
Well, I want to get back to how important that is about the role of the executives in just a couple of minutes. But first, I'd like to ask, what does ExxonMobil say about that early research now?
So ExxonMobil Global has taken a rather interesting position. They own up to it. They said, of course, we did that research, and we've continued to do research for 40 years. And they basically, what they take issue with is our description of the different direction they start to go in 1989 when they joined a U.S.-based coalition called the Global Climate Coalition that worked very hard to delay action on cutting fossil fuel emissions. And that's when, here in the U.S., we see this political muscle coming from big business to stop action on climate change, 1989 and onward. And Exxon spent millions and millions of dollars on that denial effort. When we went to Exxon and we said and asked them questions about their research, they didn't deny that the research went on in the 70s, but what they denied was that they actually ever cast doubt on climate change, or, you know, they make it seem that their response to what they did in the 90s onward, when their chairman, Lee Raymond, was deriding climate modeling, for example, their response to that is, well, our positions have always been in the mainstream of science. And, my question is, well, who determines what that mainstream is? I mean, do you determine it? Because everybody else thinks, you know, has described you as a denier. So it's been a very interesting discussion with Exxon, because they own up to the research, but they deny that they ever denied or muddied climate change or perceptions of climate research. And when we've pushed them for greater detail and more detailed responses, they just took their marbles and went home. They are not taking our questions anymore.
Wow. The Global Climate Coalition, it sounds like an activist group, but
in
an Orwellian twist, it's the opposite. Well, okay, folks, you're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News. So your project was taken up by the American public broadcasting show Frontline. They're doing a feature on your research. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, so far, it's been rather limited to this series and to that first story. What we might do further with Frontline is still under discussion. So I can't really tell you more than what we've done so far. But they're the ones who definitely secured that footage of Exxon's tanker and the scientists on the tanker and so on. That footage is actually available from the University of Texas archives, the library where the Exxon archives are. And those archives are pretty sanitized. It's basically Exxon's public statements, but that footage is there nonetheless.
All right, so it's my understanding that the oil and coal companies learned from the tobacco company campaigns to sow doubt about the science, for tobacco was between smoking and cancer. Is that the way you see it?
You know, I think that kind of connection is something that politicians and especially lawyers can, I'll leave it to them to determine that. But what we do see is one place where I think the comparison falls apart between, say, what Exxon was doing, what the tobacco industry did, is that from what I understand, the tobacco industry, you know, the companies got the research results from their scientists, their in-house scientists, and then suppressed them. Exxon did not suppress any of this science. In fact, they publicized it, and they, as I said, they published in peer-reviewed journals. They sponsored symposia on climate change back in the early 80s. They funded research at Columbia and at Woods Hole in Massachusetts, you know, sort of premier laboratories. And so, you know, they understood that climate change and the regulatory response to it could be a risk to their business. The reason that they did their research and then publicized it is because they wanted to be taken seriously when those discussions about curtailing fossil fuel emissions would begin. And they thought, you know, the best way to protect their business was to be a constructive player in the science and in the discussion. Now, that's a very different approach to climate change and the threat that it poses to fossil fuel companies than Exxon took starting in 1989 with the Global Climate Coalition and so on.
So ExxonMobil says they've stopped funding climate denialists. When did that happen, and do you believe them?
So far, we don't see any reason not to believe them. I think it happened about 5 years ago.
And are Exxon executives still sowing doubt about the link between fossil fuels and climate change?
They don't really comment on it. You know, we asked their public relations representative, you know, does Exxon accept that fossil fuel emissions are driving climate change? And they don't really comment on it.
I think there was one statement by, was it Tillerson just recently on that?
They don't actually comment on the link between fossil fuel emissions and climate change. They do say that, you know, increased CO2 is driving climate change and so on. The difference is that Rex Tillerson, the chairman, while accepting climate change, believes that human society is infinitely adaptable and that this can be solved not through a reduction in fossil fuel combustion, but by some kind of engineering solution. He sees it as an engineering problem and not as a problem of fuel choice. And when he was asked at their shareholder meeting this year by one of their shareholders, you know, whether Exxon shouldn't invest more in renewable energy, his response was that Exxon does not lose money on purpose, meaning that, you know, he just brushed aside any notion of Exxon having a greater focus on renewable energy. And that comment drew a lot of laughs from his allies there.
Yep, we're going to stay in the oil business until we're driven out of it. That seems to be their position. Well, I asked you about what executives knew and when, because just in the news, a peanut company CEO was sentenced to 28 years in jail for knowingly selling tainted peanut butter, and about a dozen people died and many more people got sick. But when we compare that to maybe 100,000 people killed in climate-fueled heat waves already, more from the spread of tropical diseases, crop failures, floods, forest fires, maybe it won't be too long before oil company executives are hauled before the courts, charged with some sort of climate crimes. What's your opinion on that?
You know, I don't know what the response is going to be. And, you know, and I'll leave it to juries and judges to determine whether that's good or bad. I mean, what, you know, that's not my role as a journalist. You know, if I were a columnist, it would be something different. But I do think that people, you know, we've gotten indications that members of Congress are watching this closely. Now, the Congress is controlled by the Republican Party, and you know, then the Republican Party in the U.S. considers it basically an article of faith to either deny climate change or, actually, it's softened that recently, and they just basically don't want to take any action on climate change. So while the Republicans control the U.S. Congress, nothing will probably happen as far as congressional hearings and so on, akin to, say, the hearings that happened with the tobacco industry decades ago. But if that were to change in 2016 with the elections, then, you know, you might have congressional hearings. If there are attorneys general on the state level that are looking into this and see some way of addressing this through litigation, that might happen. Maybe the Justice Department will take a look at this. We don't really know. We don't, you know, especially entities, institutions like the Justice Department, government lawyers do not talk to us, so we don't have any insights into what they might do.
All right. Well, let's just talk about the giant opportunity lost when Exxon decided to fund climate denial instead of following up on their early research role. I wonder, what could they have done instead?
Perhaps we should start with what they did. What they did starting in 1989 was not just join this global climate coalition, but over 25 years, they funded as climate denier organizations. And what, and especially what a lot, what the think tanks they funded do is that they create an artificial narrative, not based on science, that says that you know, that the science is too murky, it's too uncertain, and that the changes to the economy are too expensive, so we shouldn't take action. And these institutions look reputable. They've gotten all this money from Exxon and other climate deniers. And so then Exxon can point to these institutions, which they started, and say, see, you know, this reputable institution says that we shouldn't take action. You know, Exxon's allies in Congress or even in the White House can also point to the studies that these various front groups do. And so, you know, what you have is an enormous infrastructure that Exxon funded that generates fodder for their arguments and that creates doubt. And that has helped enormously to delay action in the United States on climate change and to muddy public perceptions of what's really happening and what scientists really think. So if Exxon had not taken that position, if Exxon had continued to do research, even if it had remained neutral, I think that machinery of doubt would be less powerful than it is now. And there might have been a greater push to get something done. If Exxon had actually followed the science and said, you know, we are going to gradually shift away from fossil fuels and focus more on alternative energy, then, you know, we might actually be looking at an entirely different landscape in the United States. And there might be a carbon tax now, or cap and trade, or a greater use of alternative energy, including in the transportation sector. And that would have really changed the game. We won't know, will we? Because it didn't happen.
So this is part of a series you're doing. What's coming up next?
What's coming up next is, well, so today we ran a story about modeling, Exxon's internal climate modeling, and how that confirmed the scientific consensus, and they actually use words like consensus, words that they derided a decade later in the 90s. Coming up next week, hopefully next week, is a story about how Exxon's understanding, their corporate understanding of the risks that CO2 posed to the environment, how that understanding shaped certain business decisions that they made in the 80s. So not, you know, in the 90s or even now, but 35 years ago.
For anyone who doesn't know, Neela, what is Inside Climate News and where do people find you?
So Inside Climate News is a nonprofit, very small nonprofit investigative news site focusing on climate change issues. We won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago for a series about a pipeline leak, and we are funded by American foundations, and we can be found at insideclimatenews.org.
Insideclimatenews.org, that's pretty easy, and I think people will go and visit you there for sure. Our guest, Neela Banerjee, is a senior investigative journalist with Inside Climate News. They're bringing out a startling new series on early climate research by the oil company Exxon. What they knew, and when. Get it all at insideclimatenews.org, and you can find links to some YouTube interviews with former Exxon scientists in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Neela, thanks so much for your great work and for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. There is no doubt in my mind that executives of companies who know climate change will cause incalculable damage to our civilization and all nature will eventually be charged with crimes against humanity and against nature, at the very least. It may be posthumously for some. Others will be brought out, as we saw the 80- and 90-year-old Nazi war criminals still prosecuted. There are not enough words to describe the enormity of knowing your product will wreck the climate, knowing that the public could have and should have been warned, and trying to hide it all to make a buck. When cities go underwater during storms and then permanently, when fires and floods wreck our homes, when the species say goodbye forever, when the heat of hell breaks loose, surely that is beyond forgiveness. I'm Alex Smith, that's my opinion, and this is Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
There is another future cast sure to wreck on the rocks of harsh reality. The United Nations predicts there will be over 11 billion humans on the Earth by the year 2100. Our next guest explains why that isn't going to happen, and why most of us have already lived the most prosperous years of our lives. Throughout history, there have been times of mass famine until this century. Children today have hardly heard that word in the news. That may be about to change. Joel K. Bourne Jr. is one of the top agriculture journalists. His work appears regularly in National Geographic and other publications. His new book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel Bourne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's nice to be here.
Well, ever since Malthus in the 1700s and up to the Ehrlichs in the 1970s, people have been warning there's an upper limit to the food we can make on this planet, yet we seem to be feeding billions more people. Why should we pay attention to the idea of peak food now?
Very good question. And of course, when we're here in the United States in the land of plenty, it's with the grocery stores shelves still full, it's kind of curious to talk about world hunger. And yet, what we've seen since the turn of the century in 2000, we started to gradually see demand outstripping supply. So in the first 12 years since 2000, we actually consumed or otherwise utilized more of the three major grain crops, rice, wheat, and corn, than we actually grew in 8 out of the 12 years, the first 12 years of this century, which was part of the thing that triggered the enormous volatility of food prices that occurred in 2008 and again in 2010 and again in 2012. So what we're starting to see is very highly volatile food prices based on this relationship, but where our demand from population growth, increased meat consumption, and our increased use of grain for biofuels is putting a lot of pressure on our global grain supplies.
It sounds like a simple, almost stupid question, but how could humans consume more food than we produce?
Oh, well, that's, yeah, because every year we typically produce more than we need, and we put it in storage, essentially. We have overages on good years that we store. And so what happened was we have been whittling down our stockpiles to some of the lowest levels we've seen since the 1970s, when about a quarter of the world's people were hungry. And this is another thing that causes markets to flutter, because when they see the stockpiles getting down to 68, 70 days of supply, then it makes the investors start to really worry and starts the prices to rise. So, again, we're not talking about eating more than we grow. We're talking about using up the old grain from the previous year.
So one person who's been keenly watching grain supplies is Lester Brown. He founded the World Watch Institute and then the Earth Policy Institute. Has Brown affected your own work?
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the inspirations for this. He's one of the few people who've really taken a hard look at agriculture and its impact, not just on ecosystems, but the climate and on population and on our economy. And, of course, Brown was the first one to raise the flag about who's going to feed China in the early 1990s. And I spend an entire chapter in the book talking about China's incredibly stringent growth in meat demand, where they're eating more and more hogs every year as their population increases in wealth and more of their people move into the middle class. They tend to eat more meat, and their meat consumption has almost doubled in the last decade alone, and it's projected to keep on growing. Same with India, although there they're eating more dairy. And when people eat more meat and more dairy, it's a multiplier effect for grain, because these livestock tend to be fed either corn or wheat in many parts of the world. So that's part of the problem. And, of course, Lester Brown has been on it, oh, gosh, since the 1960s, yeah.
I think one good example that you write about is Egypt's food problem. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Egypt is one of these incredible examples. It's sort of the world food problem in a nutshell. So Egypt used to grow enough wheat to feed all its people in the 1960s, even enough to start even export wheat to some of its neighbors. But because of population growth in Egypt has almost quadrupled since the 1960s, their farmers were just unable to keep up. Now, Egypt eats more wheat per capita than any other nation in the world. They are so dependent on it, they call it Aish, which is their word for life. And as a result, they have become one of the greatest are the largest importer of wheat on the planet. And so they are so dependent on the world grain markets that when we saw the big fluctuations in wheat prices, where they tripled in 2008 to the highest inflation-adjusted price since World War I, we saw bread lines in Egypt. We saw food riots. Several people died in the scramble to get subsidized bread that the army, they had to call in the army to and the army bakeries to make for the people. It was just a tragic food crisis, and it was not the only country that experienced it. Several, about a dozen other countries had food riots around the world that year.
You know, Joel, we've had scientists on this show say that climate change may have begun almost 10,000 years ago with the development of agriculture, but how is modern agriculture adding to climate change?
Great question. And I talked to a couple of chapters of this in the book. Because of the way we currently farm, with our heavy petroleum-invested agriculture, you know, most of our fertilizers derive from ammonia and natural gas, as well as other that's mined. It's very chemical, very oil-intensive. We are actually contributing the whole food production system a third of global emissions every year. We are literally farming ourselves out of food this way. And this is why. A study came out a few years ago on looking at projecting the impacts of climate change on our ability to grow food for ourselves. This is from the Royal Society in London, one of the oldest scientific groups in the world. And they projected if we get to a 4 degrees Celsius increase, which our emissions are currently on track to do by the end of the century, it could make half of our agricultural land either less suitable or even unsuitable for agricultural use. So at that point, our population is projected to be 11.2 billion people. So that's adding 4 billion more people on the planet, four more Chinas, four more Indias. So feeding that many more people with half the available agricultural land is one of those real facts that just studies that I sort of stood up and said, wow, this can't happen. There's no way these numbers can meet, and we have to do something about it, or else millions upon millions of people are going to find themselves in very, very dire straits.
Well, I've seen maps showing how deserts may spread around the subtropics, and that includes the U.S. Southwest. But also, rising seas could flood some of the world's most productive and populated river deltas. Did you look into that?
We did. Places like Bangladesh, where so many people live in these flood-prone areas and where so much rice is produced for these countries, are in the crosshairs of climate change. The other thing we look at in the book is the melting of the glaciers, the great Asiatic glaciers in the Himalayas, all of which are losing mass. And they feed, they are the main water supply for these tremendous rivers that irrigate vast swaths of Asia. Fully half of Asia is fed by the meltwaters of these rivers that are disappearing because the glaciers are melting. So these are other ways where water is becoming increasingly constrained around the world, both for irrigation, but also as sea levels rise, flooding these incredibly important delta areas that produce the bulk of Asia's rice. Yes, they're sort of caught in a vice in that way.
Vegans and vegetarians claim meat is a big part of the world food problem, and you alluded to that already. Could you enlarge on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned one study in the book that says if you feed your average family of four a hamburger dinner, it's like taking them for a 100-mile ride in your car. The emissions and the grain needed to, and grain and water needed to grow cattle particularly, is incredibly high. It's one of the least efficient ways to produce animal protein. So we talk about, one of the easiest and simplest things we could do to reduce our demand on the planet as well as the food supply is to eat less meat, particularly red meat like beef. The good news is aquaculture, which I've written a whole chapter on, can be done in a very sustainable way, particularly when you grow omnivorous fish that don't require small pelagic fish for feed. Incredibly efficient way to grow very healthy animal protein that's delicious and healthful, full of omega-3 fatty acids, everything that we need, if we can just sort of transition off the hamburgers and on to the fish sticks. If you can get population to move in that direction, we'll do ourselves all a great favor.
Well, we have a lot of aquaculture in British Columbia, but it has polluted some of our fjords, and there are some difficulties with the Atlantic salmon being raised in the Pacific escaping. So are there ways that we can get around the drawbacks to our present form of aquaculture?
Oh, absolutely. And again, most people are sort of scared of aquaculture because of the experience they've had both with shrimp farms in the tropics, tearing up mangroves, as well as the salmon farms, growing exotic species in areas with all this escapement and disease. But there are many ways we can grow fish that are both fish and shellfish that are actually beneficial to our local coastal environments. And actually, I did mention in the aquaculture chapter a researcher at the University of Vancouver who's looking at this thing called integrated multitrophic aquaculture, where he's grown about 12 native species in one experimental aquaculture farm, a former salmon farm. And all of them are sort of feeding off the waste of the other. So he's feeding one species, which is black cod, delicious fish, very highly prized, surrounding the pens with sugar kelp, growing lantern baskets full of scallops, and even has sea cucumbers on the bottom, sort of hoovering up the waste that everything else has left behind. So this wonderful sort of cyclic route, I call it like an aquatic organic garden, where he's got a number of different species that he's producing that are all living very low on the food chain and also helping to clean the water as they do it. So there are many ways we can produce fish and shellfish that actually clean up local waters. Shellfish, oyster farming in particular, is a great way, and mussel farming, to get sediment and nutrients out of the water.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Joel K. Bourne, author of the new book, The End of Plenty. We're talking about the food you eat. Well, Joel, we talked about climate change, and one big driver of that is deforestation. Is that all due to demand for wood and paper, or is food also behind deforestation as well?
Well, food is a huge driver, Alex. And one of the chapters when I talk about, we're looking at the enormous increase in hog production in China. China no longer grows enough grain to feed both its people and its hogs. So they've moved on to the market en masse to buy soybeans from places like Brazil and Argentina, where the soy revolution just rolled in to Mato Grosso and some of these areas in Brazil that move the cattlemen out and into the Amazon and contributed to this incredible deforestation we saw there in the 1990s. Now, it slowed in the 2000s to 2010s. We got it down to about 13 million hectares a year, still apocryphal, but you know, lower than it was. But only recently, as the price of soybeans rose, we started to see deforestation increase again in Latin America. And again, that's unsustainable. There's no way we can do that. Now, if we don't increase our production, and scientists now say that we need to almost double the amount of grain that we're currently producing by 2050. If we don't do that, then the other alternative is to expand into these forested areas. And some estimates had put that as much as 1 billion to 1.5 billion hectares of new land that will be coming out of the forest. And, of course, that would be a terrible thing for our climate.
How big a factor are biofuels in diverting food production into our cars, and is it just happening in the United States?
Biofuels are a huge factor. I mean, we're currently dumping 40% of the U.S. corn crop, and the United States is the Saudi Arabia of corn. We're dumping 40% of our corn crop into our cars through corn-based ethanol, and that's enough grain, to put it in perspective, to feed everyone in Africa for a year. It's an enormous amount of grain and also enormous amount of land that's being taken out of food production. In Europe, of course, they run mostly diesel vehicles. They're doing very similar things through these government mandates with things like rapeseed, canola oil, sunflower oil that is displacing land that once grew wheat. So again, these things are shoving food grains aside and increasing prices so that they're now actually making food prices directly linked to fuel prices on the world markets, which is not a great way to go. Now, everyone has said, oh, well, this is just a transition. We're going to move out of these crops and into second-generation biofuels that don't compete with food crops. But unfortunately, that just hasn't happened. 90 to 95% of all the biofuel produced in the United States comes from corn ethanol still. And unfortunately, the second-generation biofuels have not made a dent in our massive biofuel mandate. So weaning ourselves off food grade and biofuels is one of the easiest and best things we can do.
One of the big themes of your National Geographic article and the book, both titled The End of Plenty, is the role of the green revolution. But was it really green in the environmental sense of the word?
Not at all. It was green. It was labeled green by the head of USAID at the time, who was referring to the greening of the fields. But it was in no way green as we think of that today in terms of environmental impacts. It was a double-edged sword. Even though it produced an enormous amount of food and basically went from having about 30% of our global population in constant hunger to about 12% today, the environmental impacts were severe. We've got enormous groundwater and estuary pollution from all the fertilizers we're dumping on our bread baskets. We've got pesticide pollution that's contaminating groundwater and causing horrible health effects in places like India, where I reported on in the book. And, it's just the water use has just been dramatic. People think of the Green Revolution as high-yielding seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides, but none of them work very effectively without irrigation. And what we've seen is enormous drawdowns of our groundwater aquifers thanks to the irrigation that was promulgated by the Green Revolution. So we're seeing constraints and impacts on all those fronts.
Few people are aware that British Petroleum put out a report saying that affordable gas and oil that companies could really use and make money on will be gone in 50 years. What does that mean to these projections for world food production?
That's really interesting. interesting when they talk about affordable, because, you know, many of my colleagues reported on the peak oil phenomenon that they thought was going to happen in 2000, and that was right before fracking and all these different types of deep water oil resources came online, and suddenly now oil is cheaper than it's been in 30 years. So some of these projections have gone by the wayside, but certainly our energy demand is very closely connected to our food demand. One of the chapters in the book I focus on is organic agriculture, which are using much fewer fuels, much less energy to grow basic crops that are competitively in yield to conventional crops. So there are ways we can farm that is not so energy intensive, that's also better for the planet and better for our water supplies for sure.
Are genetically modified crops going to save us from a world food crisis?
Well, you know, when I was at NC State, these were touted as the miracle crops. The technology was just coming out in the early 1980s when I was in ag school, and my professors were sort of beside themselves with what these things were going to do for us, right? We're going to be able to vaccinate all the children in the world from treatable diseases with carrying the vaccines and the foods they ate. You know, we're going to be able to reduce nutrient deficiencies by putting the nutrients in the staple crops. And here we are 30 years later, 35 years later, and we've got two blockbuster traits from GMOs. We've got the Roundup Ready transgene and the BT transgene. And they're both, while they haven't caused the great environmental or health problems that we were afraid of, they haven't done an enormous amount of good. They've helped us reduce the amount of toxic pesticides we sprayed on crops like cotton, and they've helped with some soil erosion issues in the Midwest by allowing us to farm no-till with Roundup. But, you know, we're already starting to see resistance to these pesticides and herbicides. And now the big companies like Monsanto are starting to breed new things that are resistant to older, more toxic chemicals like 2,4-D, which is really almost like going backwards. These chemicals have been around since the 1950s and 60s. So it's really not the right way to go. However, the technology is getting so much cheaper. It's now becoming in the realm of the land-grant researchers, the nonprofit researchers, who are just now starting to use that technology to make crops that benefit poor farmers in Asia and they have great public benefits. So I think the technology is powerful. We have to view it on a case-by-case basis. But I think it's too promising to just put on a shelf and say, you know, we're not going to do this. The problems ahead of us are so large. I think we're going to need every tool in the toolbox to address them.
You know, a lot of people in the West presume that famine or at least persistent hunger may reappear in faraway places like Asia or Africa, but we've just seen a scientific study showing that the drought in Syria starting around 2006 drove a lot of farmers off the land, and maybe that's part of the refugee crisis we're seeing in Europe right now. So food is now so global, it can all come back to us one way or another, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think once we're looking at the true causes of what's happening in Europe, whether it's through Syria or Afghanistan, if you look at Yemen, you look at any of these countries, food security is almost at the rock bottom. They're having an extremely difficult time feeding themselves. Parts of the Horn of Africa that are moving up through Libya, same problem. They're having enormous problems. And this is not only a food security issue, but it's, as we see in Europe, it's becoming a national security issue. And one of the gentlemen I interviewed and who blogged for the book was General Hugh Shelton, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, who recognizes this. He was in Sarajevo in Yugoslavia, and he saw all these what hunger can do to people and how desperate it makes them. And I think we're seeing some of that now. Unless we can come up with a better way to farm to help these communities, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, feed their people better, then I think this is just the beginning. We're going to see a lot of migration, a lot of people trying to get out of areas that can no longer sustain them to places that can. And I don't think the United States is going to be immune. We'll see a lot of the same thing in Latin America, South America, with people trying to come north.
Well, on the other hand, tell us about a couple of the more positive solutions that you've found popping up around the world.
Yeah, the first part of the book really looks at the great challenges, the hurdles we have to feed everybody equitably by 2050. And the last half of the book really looks at these solutions. So one of the great ones, of course, is yield gaps. Places like the United States, Europe, Australia, China have enormously high yields, partly based on the Green Revolution paradigm, but also partly based on what some of the organic growers are doing. Now, other places like sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia that I mentioned earlier, have very low yields, pathetic yields. And yet with technology we have off the shelf, either agroecological or conventional, we can help those people grow an enormous amount of more food just by getting them up to sort of the world average for their maize yields or their wheat yields or their rice yields. Now, irrigation. Well, we talk a lot about that in the book in terms of using micro-hydro, or what we call our micro-irrigation, that's now becoming very cost-effective for even the poorest farmers to use, which has a 90% efficiency. So even if you've got a limited amount of water, you can use that very effectively to help increase your yields. And irrigated cropland yields 2 to 3 times that of rain-fed cropland. So it's an easy way to do that. Not easy, not cheap all the time, but certainly effective, and if we can help them do that. We can certainly cut out grain-based biofuels. Man, that's low-hanging fruit. We can eat lower on the food web, which reduces our demand for beef and other grain-intensive meats that makes more grain available for others. So, you know, even in developed countries, we eat far too much meat, eat far too many calories as it is. So cutting back on our own consumption is enormously important. And the biggest thing, I think, and the thing that I stressed in the last chapter of the book, is we need to foment a pink revolution in many parts of the world. And what I mean by this is we need to help these countries where women still on average have 5 to 7 children during their lifetime make the demographic transition to having 2 or 3, getting their fertility rates down to replacement value. And we do this fairly simply by educating girls through at least the 6th grade, ideally through high school. And by educating women, giving them equal rights to men in many of these countries, you unleash an enormous amount of potential for half of their population. And we've seen that every time they get, you know, have access to family planning services, have access to contraceptives, and are educated to at least the 6th grade, fertility rates drop on their own without sort of draconian one-child policies or forced sterilizations that we saw in the 60s and 70s. It's sort of just the natural trend. And if we can do anything we can to help that, then we'll be, we'll be doing them a favor in helping, liberate their women, and we'll be doing ourselves a favor by helping them become more self-sufficient.
Joel K. Buren has the most complete and authoritative work I've seen on the giant subject of world food. It's called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. You can find out more at joelkburen.com, and you'll get more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I know you've been swamped with interviews, Joel, so thanks so much for taking the time to join us on this important subject.
Alex, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Our storybooks are filled with wild and magical animals, spotted jaguars, crafty tigers and friendly tigers, elephants who can never forget, and crocodiles with sore teeth. Sadly, hidden behind the roar of human-based news, all that is disappearing in our lifetimes. Next week, I'm going to talk with the Venerable Paul Ehrlich about his new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. But first, I'll let Paul tell you a little bit about some of those animals in this clip from a video made by the Woods Institute.
Elephants are in deep trouble, and this is a forest elephant that's in deeper trouble than most. It was only recognized recently that forest elephants were a distinct species, and I think that distinct species may last a couple more decades at best. And this is the Indian rhino, which is very rare, like all the other rhinoceroses except the white rhino. It's severely endangered, and I suspect it won't be around for more than half a century. I don't think maybe any rhinoceroses will be around outside of zoos. The jaguar is the big spotted cat of the Western Hemisphere, sort of our equivalent of the leopard. Its range is shrinking, although it's a big range, and it may hang on to the end of this century. Nobody knows for sure. But fortunately, cats do breed well in captivity, so there'll probably be some live ones around as long as there are people around, but they won't be out in nature. Mouse lemurs, like all lemurs, live on Madagascar, and for a long time we thought there was just 2 kinds of them, but now I think they've discovered there's about 21 kinds of them. And a lot of them are very severely endangered because, of course, when you take 2 relatively rare animals and then divide them up by 10, they tend to occupy smaller areas and be more threatened. Bonobos, or pygmy chimpanzees, are our closest living relatives. They are more like us than standard chimpanzees. They solve their disputes by genital rubbing, which is something I highly recommend for our species. I think that they're going to be the next of our relatives to disappear. Grizzly bears are a good example of animals that were once very widespread and abundant and are now still widespread, but nowhere near as widespread. But they're becoming rarer and rarer. And, of course, they compete with human beings and sometimes even eat them. I think they'll be around for quite a while because there's going to be a lot of human beings for them to eat. Tigers eat human beings just like grizzly bears do. But they're very highly persecuted, and although there were many different kinds long ago, several of the subspecies have already gone extinct, and all the others are rare. And I think they'll persist in zoos for a long time because they breed well, but by the end of this century, there are going to be few, if any, left in nature. Pangolins are weird-looking animals that are still quite common in many parts of Eurasia, southern Eurasia and Africa. But they're extremely valued in Chinese medicine and things like that. Their hair is formed into weird-looking scales, and the scales are actually used. And thousands of them are now being harvested to support Chinese medicine and similar things. So they're all basically in trouble. Albatrosses are fascinating birds that stay aloft essentially forever. Except when they're breeding. They're in deep trouble very often because they get tangled in fishing lines. One of the most interesting animals in Africa is the wild dog or the hunting dog, which hunt in packs and have been severely endangered, among other things, by distemper transferred from domestic canines. They hunt as pursuit hunters and run down prey and then gobble it down and bring it back and throw it up into the mouths of their young at their dens. Fascinating animals. Not long for this world.
That was Paul Ehrlich. Be sure and tune in next week for our full-length interview. I've just got time for a couple of eclectic bits. Terence McKenna explains why the world is full of idiots. I've always wanted to know that. And then Diana Lindley charms us with her song, Lovelution. Here is the late Terence McKenna.
The great evil, in my humble opinion, which haunts our enterprise, and I say this realizing I'm setting the fox among the chickens, the great evil that has been allowed to flourish in the absence of mathematical understanding is relativism. And what is relativism? It's the idea that there is no distinction between shit and shinola. That all ideas are somehow operating on equal footing. So one person is a chaos theorist, another is a follower of the revelations of this or that New Age guru, someone else is channeling information from the Pleiades, and we have been taught that political correctness demands that we treat all these things with equal weight. Because we have no mathematical ability, no logical ability, we don't know how to ask the questions that expose some positions as preposterous, trivial, insulting to the intelligence, and unworthy of repetition. So we all are very comfortable bashing science and flailing away at that, but that isn't our enemy. Science is capable of undertaking its own reformation and critique and has been engaged in that fairly vigorously for some time. The enemy that will really subvert the enterprise of building a world based on clarity is the belief that we cannot point out the pernicious forms of idiocy that flourish in our own community. And this problem is growing worse all the time. I mean, just pick up a copy of Magical Blend or Shaman's Drum, and you will discover an appeal to the level of intellect that makes what's going on with television advertising look like a meeting of the Princeton Institute of Advanced Study. We have tolerated too many loose heads in our community. We are not willing to take on the karma involved in argument and discourse that actually gores somebody's ox. So that at the end of the day, iridology or Mormonism or some other form of institutionally supported foolishness lies in shreds on the floor. We consider this politically incorrect. I can feel the tension in this room because people sense I might gore their particular ox. If we had learned mathematical logic or reason or rules of evidence, when someone approaches us excited to inform us that the ruins of Lemuria have been spotted in the deep sea off Big Sur or something like that, we would be able to respond to that with the contempt it deserves. I had a conversation about this recently with someone who, if I had to describe their job category, I would describe them as mafiosa. And I said, what do you think of the abduction phenomenon? And without hesitation, this person said, there are just so many foolish people in the world. And to me, all of these things are intelligence tests. And the people who pass the intelligence test are not worrying about pro bono proctologists from other star systems showing up on a map in their bedrooms. So, you know, we have perfected politeness. We have perfected the ability to listen to damn foolishness without betraying by so much as the flick of an eyebrow that we realize what we're in the presence of. Now I think it's time to refine our mathematical skills, learn to think straight, and not be afraid to denounce the pernicious forms of foolishness which are vitiating the energies of our community and making us appear marginal and absurd in the discourse about truly transforming society.
That was Terence McKenna. Diana Lindley is a Canadian, a Vancouver Islander, who feels driven to get this song, Lovolution, out there. There are several versions, including a very neat YouTube video which features childlike crayon drawings by the Japanese team of Kanata and Yoko Kikuchi. The full-length version was made for the New York City Climate March. You can see all that on YouTube. Let the skeptics and the harsh critics lay down their weary burdens. Let's reach for the child inside and for the children at our side. We need to find a way to end our war against nature. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Climate change affects everyone.
Come, come, join this revolution. Warriors, heed the calling of your hearts. Come, come, be part of the solution. Wherever you are, it's a place to start.
Together, we can save the world we love.
Whoever you are, with what you've got, follow your heart, play your part. Whoever you are, take action. Come, come, be part of the solution. Right. place to start.